Welcome to Football with Grant Wall. Thanks so much for joining me. Today's interview guest is Dermot McQuarrie, a former Fox Sports TV executive who pioneered bringing European soccer leagues to American television, turning the U.S. from one of the world's worst countries to watch soccer in into one of the best. We've had some great guests lately, including Rob Harris, Miguel Delaney, and Paul Tenorio. I also encourage you to check out my podcast series, American Prodigy, The Freddie Adu Story. All 8 episodes are out. But first, let's break down the soccer weekend with my friend Chris Whittingham, who you can hear on Univision, Inter Miami Radio, The Dan Le Batard Show, and the Chelsea Mic'd Up podcast, among other many places, as you can tell. Chris, thanks for joining me. How are you?
How is there still among other after all that? I feel bad for how long my intro is.
It's kind of good, though. That means you're busy. Yeah, you are busy. Everywhere these days, and it's fun to hear you doing such a great job on broadcasts. We mentioned Univision, like the English language for the Univision MLS national broadcasts. I just realized this past week my TV is a new TV. It's equipped. I have a TV now for the first time to hit the SAP button so I can hear you.
Nice.
Which is kind of nice. You're also a part of the long tradition of the MLS SAP hashtag, which
yes.
Someday we may get into a history of, especially if we have Pablo Maurer on, because he documented that. Just listeners, do a Twitter search on MLS SAP hashtag, and there'll be plenty of good stuff there. Lots to talk about this week. Crazy week, wild week in the history of soccer. And obviously the story of the week is still the crash and burn of the Super League. And now that a few days have passed, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, because you mentioned it's kind of one of the most historic and remarkable moments, and it was actually interesting to me because of how much the sport kind of crossed into the mainstream. It was a slow sports week, and so you got to hear general sports pundits give their thoughts, and on the Dan Le Batard Show, you mentioned that. I thought actually Dan was remarkably kind of ahead of the beat on this, where he was just like, so this is one of the biggest sports stories ever, right? And I'm like, yeah, it kind of is, because it's the world's biggest sport being completely redone. And it is just so remarkable. And I think we'll look back in 3 years, 5 years. First off, the Super League now has that attached to it for the remainder of time, right? We will always remember what those 48 hours were like. But even beyond that, for me, the enduring legacy is just how quickly it fell apart and how quickly, under the weight of public pressure, which these leagues and these clubs had to know was coming, they still completely fell under public pressure. And it is still cool, right? Because at times in America, you know, the NFL just seems like it's such a titanic business that no matter what it does, it's strong enough to persevere. That every once in a while, big business, big sports business is reminded that, oh no, the fan's voice matters. And it matters to the tune of your thing no longer existing. So it was really cool for like fan power to be demonstrated in that way.
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that. And part of me is like, well, how long will it be before these guys try to do it again? And what's interesting to me, at least as of right now, in the first few days after this happened, like the continental clubs, Real Madrid, Juventus, Barcelona in particular, are like totally unrepentant. Like, they're still like, yeah, Super League's going to happen, man. and apparently not reading the headlines. And so I really do think it's going to be on the English teams and those who put pressure on the English teams, like we saw over the past week, to prevent this from happening again. Because any Super League is going to need the English teams. Otherwise, you can't do it. You know, nobody's going to care if the Big Six of England are not involved. If it's just a Super League of Spanish and Italian teams, that's not going to work.
That's like the Dutch-Belgian league that's being floated. You're basically combining domestic leagues. The other thing, too, is it's not just the English clubs, by the way. Everyone kind of needs everyone in order to make this work. Because I actually thought one of the turning points was when it was announced that Bayern wasn't joining.
Right.
I don't think that Bayern in the German system, and look, I think the 50-plus-1 ownership model has gotten a lot of credit in the last week, but I don't think we really talked about enough what the outcome of that 50-plus-1 ownership model was, which is Bayern wasn't in. And for whatever reason, PSG wasn't in. I don't know why. Partially it's because, you know, Bayern owns such a huge amount of Premier League and Champions League rights that you're basically kind of stepping on your own toes by doing this. But also, this thing is interdependent. It needs everyone, right? Because it would have felt incomplete even if the English clubs had stayed in without Bayern Munich, PSG, and maybe even Borussia Dortmund as well.
Yeah, and I think it's worth asking ourselves, well, why were the German clubs so instantly out? You know, and I think you're right. The 50-plus-1 rule has a huge impact on that. Though somebody said something that they thought if it had gone to a vote of the Barcelona social members, that they might have supported the Super League, which is kind of crazy to me if we're talking about membership having an issue with all of this. But it certainly has had an impact on how I've watched games this week. And I have to admit to you, even though the Super League was put down very quickly and the Super League was stunningly incompetent in how they went about their rollout, and it looks like, you know, Champions League is still going to go ahead this week as planned with the semifinals. Nobody's getting kicked out, at least for this year's tournament. And we'll see what kind of punishments there are moving forward. But it was a little harder for me to get too up for this weekend's games. It definitely was midweek. And I'm just curious, I don't know the answer. Am I going to feel the same way on Tuesday when the UEFA Champions League semifinals start and it's Chelsea Real Madrid? Am I going to, I think I'll probably get up for it.
You know what's funny is that I actually think it'll be more in my mind then, because basically you'll be viewing it through the prism of, oh, they tried to deny us this, right? They wanted so that this was guaranteed, and like this isn't enough for them, I think, is kind of a lot of the backdrop for that contest. Whereas for me, like, in the immediate aftermath, I was kind of enjoying how these Super League teams kept dropping results. The Super League record was kind of a disaster after they announced that Arsenal, you know, scraping for a point against Fulham. There was all these terrible results. But I think the Champions League will probably weigh more on my mind than even the domestic football did this weekend. But the other kind of point that I wanted to make about the Super League was it really demonstrates the limited capacity that owners, and I guess more broadly rich people, have in making their ideas popular, right? Because ultimately, this was not an idea that was run by coaches. It was not an idea that was run by players. This was the rich people who got together to create this idea. And they don't seem to know how to get out in public and explain themselves, because they let the managers go out. The managers weren't caring. Pep Guardiola might have been the most vocal opponent of the Super League in kind of the immediate aftermath of someone who was directly involved. So it really just goes to show how limited those guys are in putting forth a vision that they seem to support on a forward-facing, public-facing basis.
And still, the only club leader who went out there publicly was from Real Madrid, Florentino Perez.
Yeah.
And he just seemed like way out of touch.
Yeah.
In a comical way.
Full on wrestling heel.
Yeah. But like nobody else would do it. And like, you know, it's obvious like the Glazers weren't going to do that. We barely ever see them in public anyway. But like the fact that John W. Henry, the Liverpool owner, did not want to be the one to go out to do it should have been a message to himself. Oh, maybe this isn't a great idea. if I'm not willing to do this and we can't find someone to sell this to the public, because clearly Florentino Perez wasn't that guy, they should have had someone who was at least going to make a good case. I almost wonder if our previous podcast guest, Ivan Gazidis, would have been that man.
Yeah.
Because he could have, I as a younger guy, and you know, listeners go back and listen to the podcast if you want to hear it, he's a good talker. And Ivan, I think, would have been somebody to put out there, but maybe he didn't want to do it. We should get him back on the podcast and ask.
Yeah, I mean, who knows, like, kind of how unpopular everyone wants to be? But on a broader scale, it's something that we've talked about before. But owners are kind of quiet, right? And I would say that in sports media, ownership is among the least covered things that there is in sports, right? We know so little about sports owners. We know so little about what makes them tick. We know so little about how they want to run their clubs and in America, their franchises. Sports ownership is pretty poorly covered, and it's by design. Owners don't want to be covered, and so they never grant interviews. But I mean, you rarely get the kind of insights you see, like, for example, from Don Van Natta of ESPN, who writes a long profile piece of Jerry Jones. It's only because Jerry Jones is so desperate for publicity that he agreed to do it. But, like, there aren't very many Jerry Joneses that let you in on the machinations of their business.
They're all in the Dallas area. Mark Cuban.
Yeah.
Whole thing. I've done, like, one NFL magazine story in my life, and it involved interviewing Jerry Jones, who is, like, so willing to be interviewed. It was awesome.
Like, right. He goes on sports.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he goes on, like, Sports Talk Radio the morning after the game, and, like, there's a press conference after the game. Like, in some ways, like, people make fun of him for that, but, like, from our standpoint, I want to hear more from owners. Like,
yeah.
Owners are fairly clandestine.
No, that's totally true. Now, I want to ask you this as well, because I do think it is worth having a discussion about soccer in the United States and its connection to the Super League, and in particular, what we view as the sanctity of the open soccer pyramid in Europe. And we heard that a lot this week, and it's one of the things that people fought for and were repulsed by in, you know, all over Europe, particularly in England, but a few other places, the fact that the Super League teams would have perennially been in the Super League. They would not get relegated from the Super League. They wouldn't have to earn their spot in their domestic leagues. These 15 teams, or the 12 that we knew of, would always be in the Super League. Obviously, here in the United States, in our professional sports leagues, including in MLS, these are closed leagues. No promotion, no relegation. And I thought about tweeting this, and then it just hit me of this is Twitter, so this will not work probably. I think it is possible to believe all of these things, because I actually believe all of these things. Mm-hmm. That one, 100 years of the open pyramid in European soccer is tremendously important and worth protecting and keeping. Two, I also think that for MLS to have gotten off the ground and gotten to the point where it is today, 25 years in, it needed to be closed over that time. And three, I believe it is also possible to incentivize the owners of MLS at some point, hopefully not too far from now, to start opening up the pyramid in the United States. Is that too much nuance for one argument?
It is ultimately a set of kind of values of stances that cannot coexist, I guess. Like, you can kind of believe all of those things. But so, like, for example, I agree with you. I think and Paul Tenorio and Sam Stasekel did a really good podcast called Allocation Disorder, which you can hear on the Total Soccer Show feed, about this whole thing and how MLS, and I had never really heard this crystallized, and I kind of love to hear a deeper dive on it, about the way that the owners or rich people in America, investors, were pitched an open pyramid. And none of them wanted to buy in. None of them wanted. They only wanted a Division I club. They didn't want a Division III club.
Before MLS.
Right, but yeah, before MLS. As they're kind of building the domestic league, which they have to build in accordance with World Cup 94. So no one wanted to invest at this level. And even as MLS was coming off the ground, there's early days where one owner owned several clubs because there just weren't people that wanted to invest. And they only wanted to invest because it was a closed single entity structure, right? That's the only way that it preserves its value. And now as you've gotten everyone to invest in the closed structure, the values of the clubs are going way up and the business is thriving. And now it's a thriving business in America. The main difference between America and Europe is that in America, we don't have the divine right for this to exist, right? There is no guarantee that American soccer exists at women's level, or the club game, the national team will always exist. But the club level, we have never had a right for this to exist. And so the more that you do have to build business-friendly structures in order to drive investment. The game needed investment. It still needs investment. We talk about pay-to-play and the academy system and all this stuff. It needs money. And so because of that, MLS needed to build in this way. And I don't think there's any going back, because now it's become an even better investment and more owners want to get involved. And ultimately, the reason why John Henry wants to bring this, and every owner, is because the valuation of these clubs goes skyrocketing up when you guarantee revenues, as is the case here in Major League Soccer. So Americans have a superior business model. I don't think there's any question about that. But it's, I would say, antithetical to competition. And so I think it's great that almost both things exist, but I would prefer for there to be promotion relegation. I just don't think it can happen. Like, from a business standpoint, why would the owner of, I don't know, what's the most recent, Austin FC, Anthony Precourt, he bought in at whatever, right? Why would he agree when he is the owner of his, when the valuation of his club is going up rather than down, say, you know what, I will agree to a system in which my entire set of revenues can be stripped of me if I have a bad season. Like, why would you agree to that? Like, and ultimately, we're too entrenched now in this system to really go the other way, unless the prize money is astronomical on the other end of it.
I guess what I would suggest is this. One, my overarching point here is, I hate when people say, well, you can't support an open system in Europe and a closed one in the U.S. Hell yeah, you can, because they're two completely different contexts, two completely different histories of what's happened over the last century in European soccer and what's happened over the last century in American soccer. And the failed leagues and all of that stuff in the U.S. Now, I hope, this is my personal hope, is that there would be a way to incentivize the MLS owners to adopt something more open, potentially promotion and relegation in the future. And so when you think about it in those terms, you ask yourself, well, who has potential leverage to do that, to incentivize them? And the obvious one is TV companies, mm-hmm. who, with a greater amount of money, could say, like, I'll give you this much money for your next 8-year contract if you adopt promotion and relegation or start moving in that direction, and you'll get this much smaller amount of money if you don't. And then you make it potentially something that the owners in MLS would want to do. And then there's always the case that people make of, like, being compelled by the U.S. Soccer Federation to say, you have to do this, you have to adopt promotion and relegation. It's hard for me to see that happening, particularly given how close MLS and the U.S. Soccer Federation have been over the years. I just don't see it happening. I also don't see FIFA or the Court of Arbitration for Sport, getting involved in all of this. It's never happened before. There have been some court cases. I don't see it happening in the future. And personally, I'd like to think there was a way to incentivize, from a business perspective, the MLS owners to open things up. Because I think several of the MLS owners, they probably wouldn't say it publicly, would be open to the idea.
I don't know if they will. I mean, like, from a competitive standpoint, obviously you buy into the notion of football, right? You get invested in what it is, but ultimately the financial value of your club is kind of tied to the fact that you're in a closed system. And how much are you going to want when you see, valuations going up around the league and, LAFC being invested in at a $700 million valuation and FC Cincinnati being, invested in at a $500 million valuation. That doesn't happen if there's promotion relegation. It just, unless you can guarantee, even with relegation, that all these clubs are going to make the same revenue, which I don't know how you can continue to slice the pie even more. But I don't see how any owner would want to do that. And look, that doesn't mean that it's a good thing, right? Maybe in this country, we have to be a bit more sympathetic to owners because of what they've done to have the game arrive at this stage. But that doesn't mean that you can still want promotion relegation. All I'm just explaining to you is that it's a bad business model, but it's a bad business model that's fun for fans, and it's why, they took to the streets in their thousands this week to protest that it stay in existence.
We'll see. I know there's some MLS owners that want to open things up, mm-hmm. from a spending perspective, certainly. And that's not the same thing as promotion and relegation. But if you can suddenly get a lot more TV revenue, like a lot more, mm-hmm. if you open things up, then there might be enough there to offset it. We'll see. I still think like potentially you could get to 40 MLS teams, have an MLS 1, MLS 2, and you're not really getting relegated. You're kind of getting relegated. Like that would probably, it would be a move toward that system, but not necessarily adopting the system completely. We could, I mean, this is a conversation that you could have year after year after year, right? There was some soccer this week. Jose Mourinho got fired in the most overshadowed big decision of its nature in a very long time. Tottenham fires Jose the week they're playing in a final, the League Cup final, which I think was, you could say, a cynical attempt to prevent Jose from even being able to say that he got a trophy at Tottenham. And
I don't even think that's cynical. I think that's accurate.
If I mean, it would have been interesting, though, if like he had won them a title in the League Cup and then they'd still fired him. Because it still seemed like his time was going to be up before too long here with Spurs. And I do wonder, where do you think Jose goes now? Like, does he become a national team manager? Does he go to a lower level club? Because it's hard to envision him going to like a really high level club at this point. Maybe I'm wrong. Do you see him like going to just complete, you know, going on sabbatical, going to MLS, going to Doha to do television? I actually tweeted, I would love to see him come to New York and do NBC just for the, even if it's just for the rest of this Premier League season, because I think it would be a lot of fun and I'm sure he has a lot to say.
Yeah, I mean, being definitely, they had him and it was like him and Wenger on the set together. That's some magic television. He would be an absolutely incredible pundit. Like, if he wants that, he's like immediately skyrockets to the top of the pundit table. But I do think he'll get back into coaching. I always kind of like wondered why he didn't want to go back to Italy. Like, Italy seems like a league that kind of gets Jose Mourinho. The Inter fans really like him. Like, I have a friend of mine who's a really big Inter fan, and he still thinks that it's annoying when his team tries to play with attack and with intent. No, like, we win trophies the Jose way. So I do think that they're like, Italy is probably the country that would most appreciate it. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like national team, that makes sense because the national team game is not really evolved in this way, right? I mean, Germany did win a World Cup playing a fairly progressive style. Spain won a World Cup playing a fairly progressive style. But you look back at the France side, they weren't scintillating in terms of the quality of their play, the quality of their build-up. You know, Portugal won the Euros without a very enthralling style of play. So you can still win in a big way at international level. I just don't know, like, Jose, if you would like it that much, because you don't get to coach very often. You're kind of at the mercy of FIFA windows. You got to negotiate with clubs. I don't know if that's really his bag. So in my view, his two choices are go back to Italy. They seem to really like him there. Or become the best television pundit there's been.
And why not? I know he wants to live in the U.S. at some point. I think his daughter is not living at home anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm still holding out hope that somebody in American television throws a truckload of cash. And I don't know if they can compete with Bein and the Qataris on that one. But, man, that would be so much fun. And I would just look forward to that. And I like NBC's broad, you know, studio stuff, but they could use you know, some changes, maybe
some pizzazz,
you know, and shake things up a little bit. And he no doubt would do that. You know, you mentioned Italy. I think that's a good shout. I almost wonder if like Napoli might be a place for Jose, for starters, because that job might come open here pretty soon, because Gattuso doesn't seem like he's necessarily a long-term guy there. And Napoli is a team that certainly has played in Champions League in recent years, certainly has challenged for the Scudetto a couple of times in recent years. Like, that seems like it might be a fit.
Yeah. And honestly, like, I don't know what his relationship is with Ronaldo at this point, but I think Juve are probably going to be looking for a manager as well. I don't know if they go the Jose. Well, they went to the Pirlo route because they didn't want to pay a huge amount of money for Pochettino. So I don't know if even that's in play. But I think there's a, you know, there's a chance that he can work at a high level of the club game. He still has an enormous amount of respect. Probably not in England. I'd say if you're running an English club at this point, you cannot go down the Jose well again. I imagine his reputation on the continent is still intact.
He also maybe could take on the, like, Sam Allardyce role of guy who you bring in to avoid getting relegated.
That would be sad. That would be sad if next year Watford sack their manager after getting promoted. They have, you know, 12 points from 17 games and Jose engineers the great escape. That would be a sad route for him to go down.
But I mean, like, that's what his style at this point, which worked to win trophies 10 years ago, but less so now. You know, that's how you get points and stay up in the league. It's not like these Premier League teams at that level don't have a lot of money themselves at this point. I think he could just be like a glorified Sam Allardyce if he wants.
That would be sad. Don't do that, Jose. Go into television if you're going to do that.
Also this weekend, Man City wins the League Cup for the fourth straight time and really dominated Spurs in this game. Like, the XG numbers were not even close. And Zach Steffen starts, as he has in all their cup games this year, essentially, and gets the win, gets a trophy, makes up for maybe not a great performance in the FA Cup when City went out in the semis to Chelsea. And now you're looking around Europe and you're seeing these U.S. national team players like Zach Steffen, Sergiño Dest with the Copa del Rey recently, Weston McKennie with the Italian Supercopa, and he's also in the Italian Cup final too with Juventus coming up. And you've possibly got more U.S. players getting trophies here. Pulisic's going to be in the FA Cup final. Who knows about Champions League at this point? Still alive there. And there's, like, it's kind of cool to see these young American players not just playing for teams but winning things. Do you put that much stock into it when it's not like the league title yet, when it's like the League Cup and stuff like that?
I don't even if they were winning league trophies and Champions Leagues and all that, obviously, like, it's really cool, and they're, like, to me, they're more factoids than they are kind of an indicator of something. To me, what it's an indicator of is you're playing in finals, right? These are grand occasions. And so if you're talking about it from an American lens, from a U.S. men's national team lens, it makes World Cup qualifiers not seem like the biggest thing ever. It makes playing in World Cup quarterfinals not seem like the biggest thing ever. And the more you can normalize big occasions, the more you would imagine not only can Americans play in those games, but express themselves. They're not overwhelmed. They're not overawed by an occasion. So it's just another game. I'm just going to play the way that I play. And that, when you talk about knockout round games for the U.S., is something that we've seen them unable to do, right? It's all you get overwhelmed by. I mean, you go back to the last knockout round the U.S. played, the game against Belgium in 2014, and they got played off the park. Like, it's a miracle that Wando had a chance to win it at the end. It's a miracle that it was a one-goal game, latter stages in extra time. Like, they got trounced in that game. And so, ultimately, playing at this level is an indicator that you're not going to be overawed when it comes to national team big occasions, Gold Cup finals against Mexico, away at the Azteca, away at Costa Rica, whatever it is. U.S. players are kind of not really going to be overawed by it. Although I will say, you're mentioning, I'm kind of talking about this out of the other side of my mouth, Zach Steffen today participated in a training session. He really did nothing, for being honest.
He had a nice save early in the second half. He had one.
I imagine he makes a save every once in a while in training. Other than that, he did absolutely nothing.
I guess that's true. It was a total domination. Spurs was very disappointing. And yet, it was still cool for me to see Zach Steffen mm-hmm. with the trophy after the game. One of my least favorite trophies in the sport, by the way. Way too small. Guys look like they're holding up like a 32-ounce can of soda. You know, like, it's that size. It's a little too small.
Oh, wow. I've never analyzed the Carabao Cup trophy. Yeah, that is tiny. Like, him and so Steffen is photographed with Ederson doing, like, the one hand on each handle, and their hands are basically on top of each other.
And by the way, what's Ederson even doing? He didn't earn that. He wasn't on the field for those games, and he's got both hands on it as if it's like, oh, look at the trophy I won. At least with Steffen, you played the games, man. You should have, like, rip that trophy away from.
You win as a team, Grant. Everyone gets to have their hands on the trophy. I thought it was cool, hopefully, by the way, that Pep stuck with him for the final. Like, could just as easily have gone to Ederson because it's the final. And after, we should say, the howler that he had last week against Chelsea in the semifinal of the FA Cup, could have just as easily gone to Ederson, given that you probably do want to get something in the cabinet before you go into the Champions League.
I will say this. As a backup keeper at City, Stefan has done far better than Claudio Bravo, for example, who was pretty poor as the backup cup goalkeeper for Man mm-hmm. City. And, you know, like, I do want to say this about Zach Stefan is his route to this point, and he's still got a ways to go at club level, but his route to this point has not been a direct line upward. Nope. You know, he went to Freiburg in Germany, and things didn't go very well there. And you actually were worried about him, and was he actually going to make it? He comes back to MLS, does really well, then he gets sold. And obviously he's been loaned out to Dusseldorf last year, stayed with Man City this year. I guess part of it, which is cool, I think, is that he has brought some value to Man City this season, and he has, it appears, Pep's trust to do certain things in a way that it's not like when Matt Miazga got sold to Chelsea, you know, and mm-hmm. you were like instantly, he's not going to play there. And he hasn't. And so, like, that to me, like, is good on Zach Stefan for getting his career moving in the right direction, putting in the work, and earning Pep's trust, because I don't think Pep is probably the easiest guy to play for.
Right, and you see almost every new transfer that comes into Man City struggle to acclimatize. Like, every new transfer takes the – other than, like, Ruben Diaz in, like, the last 5 years, I can't think of very many other transfers where they come in, hit the ground running straight away. It takes a while. Like, Bernardo Silva took a long time before he was really fully integrated into the team, and so I imagine playing goalkeeper in particular is a difficult strain. And in the end – so he started this year 12 times. You can probably presume, unless City lock away the league – which they will, and can play maybe three or four games that are meaningless. Maybe he'll start another Premier League game. But he started 12 games in this season. He's only conceded 6 goals. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this season's a real plus for Zach Stefan. So,
and you wonder, like, if maybe, like, a Premier League club, like, I mean, who knows what Everton is thinking about Jordan Pickford at this point, if they need to upgrade, like, maybe, you know, Stefan does go, like, the Manchester United route with Tim Howard, where, okay, maybe he's not going to be the number one at this club, but another club in the league will be interested, another European club with some stature will come in for him.
Want to wrap up with some MLS talk. Lots of stuff happening in MLS this weekend, week 2. Few things that stood out for me, and you're obviously watching all the Inter Miami games. The Higuain brothers both score in a come-from-behind win at a good Philly team. And what do you make of this? Is this going to be a must-watch team this year, Miami?
I don't know about must-watch. I don't know if their style of play has been enthralling, but in terms of surviving a game against Philadelphia, I mean, there were moments in that game where they were really struggling with Philly's press, and it makes sense why I think they only gave up 18 goals last year in regular season play. They won every single home game that they played last year, which, again, when you're considering Miami, how much they've struggled, getting a win there is incredible. It's probably the best win in club history, as kind of ridiculous as it might seem, winning a week two MLS match. But yeah, I mean, they survived, and then Federico Higuain, Nicolas Figal moving from center back to right back, made a real impact in his kind of lung busting runs forward, and they survived the bad stretches of that game, going 1-0 down. It felt kind of very, all right, here we go again. They actually had a pretty good performance last year in Philly, and then all of a sudden they lose 3-0. But Higuain's being involved, I actually think Federico was kind of more of an important factor. First off, it's a big call from Phil Neville, because he puts Higuain on for Pizarro, and
he wasn't Federico, very good, right?
No, I don't think he had a very good 63 minutes as a starter for Miami. So first off, you're taking off one of your big money DPs in order to bring on a 36-year-old guy, and he completely changed the game. From a keeping the ball standpoint, creating the chance, and then obviously scoring from the header. And you kind of wonder going forward, like, is Federico Higuain like a must-start player for Miami? And if so, how does that kind of what's the dominoes that fall as a result of that?
Maybe he can be the new version of Il Cigno and just come on and like give his like specific time.
he was on for like 9 minutes and came off. And it's always funny because, like, so obviously I'm in a group chat with some Miami friends of mine, but they're not really big MLS guys. Like, one of the cool things about expansion is that you kind of, through the prism of your team, get introduced to the league. And they're like, who's this El Seno guy? Not exactly in good shape, is he? And, like, I mean, it doesn't matter to El Seno. It's obviously had a huge impact on the league, but it's always funny, like, every time a new fan base gets exposed to El Seno.
And then also, Austin gets its first win in club history, and for the second straight game, they look like a real team, which is impressive after they looked okay at LAFC the week before, come from behind, win 3-1 at Colorado, and Cecilio Dominguez looks like he might be a player, and they might have someone who can score goals, which was actually one of their biggest concerns.
Yeah, and you mentioned kind of that style, and it's really impressive for a longtime assistant in Josh Wolf to kind of take a lot of Greg Berhalter's ideas, obviously some of his own, and implement a team that makes sense that also is, like, proactive. And it's really been since LAFC came into the league that someone, or that a club from day one is implementing a proactive style and it working, right? Because, like, Nashville, although all of a sudden they become chance creation monsters in year two, but in year one, they built their success off the back of a solid foundation. Miami, I think, kind of laid out a notion of playing as an attacking club, but couldn't really live up to it. Cincinnati, who even knows what they're trying to be? They're you know, some other clubs that have not exactly hit the ground running in this way, and yet Austin, even losing away at LAFC, at the very least you can see a proactive identity, a build-up, kind of connecting passes and brilliant moves going up and down the pitch, and then they went away at Colorado, a team that a lot of people fancy, and all of a sudden you kind of have to treat Austin as a legitimate playoff contender because they're not just trying to hang on, they're trying to beat you, and they successfully beat Colorado on match day two.
And they're going to have to play a lot of games at the start here on the road as they wait for their new stadium to open. So for them to get any 3-point situations in these opening games is huge for them. And partly, like you said, it's Josh Wolf, but also this is a team built by Claudio Reyna, who is not going to be building a team to just sit back and defend the entire time. So if Austin can be a team that's fun to watch, that would be a real positive, I think, for the week to week in MLS. A couple more MLS topics here. Ezequiel Barco, fantastic goal. Yeah. Atlanta beats Chicago. And it's early. And yet this Atlanta team right now seems to be much more like pre-Frank de Boer than Frank de Boer.
Which is a good thing. In terms of kind of like the level of encouragement, first off, I know that they score 3 goals and they played some decent stuff against Chicago, but I think Chicago are going to give away a lot of goals this year. I mean, we saw an opening day, they take a 2-0 lead on New England Revolution and very quickly gave it back. I did obviously their first match for Univision against Orlando, and even in moments in which they weren't really threatening towards goal, you mentioned obviously stylistically, the zip in the movement, the zip of the passing, it does look different. They got a really good holding midfielder, the young Santiago Sosa, who's got an incredible kind of right foot to distribute the ball, so you kind of have that dynamic, and I really like how they've added. Obviously, having Joseph back is fantastic, so I think Gabriel Heinze, just the way that he's coaching this team and progressing their style is such an improvement, almost independent of the results, which is why I almost draw more attention to a draw than to a win, because I don't think you say Atlanta is back because they beat Chicago. I think you say Atlanta is back because they can replicate a style of play every week.
Well, they already advanced in CONCACAF Champions League. They got a fun matchup coming this week against Philadelphia. It's the one MLS on MLS matchup in the CCL quarterfinals. So that'll be a fun thing to watch this week. And you make a good point. I mean, there have been a couple of games I've watched so far this MLS season where it's like been a tie, but it's been a quality tie where you come away from it saying, I think all of the, you know, these, both these teams are going to be pretty good. So the Atlanta-Orlando game was one of them. The LAFC-Seattle game this weekend, those seem like those are going to be, once they get everyone at full strength, two good teams in this league. Not surprising, LAFC and Seattle have been good teams for a while now, but like, I think it's worth noting that things to pay attention to aren't just when a 5-0 happens like NYCFC against Cincinnati, where you come away from that thinking, at least for me, the dominant thing was, wow, Cincinnati's still really bad and can't defend a set piece. But it's some of these other games too, where it may just be a tie, but like you get a sense that they were really canceling each other out, and this was some pretty decent stuff being played. One last thing I want to talk about with you on MLS. We had a dust up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, I guess it's St. Paul, between Minnesota and Real Salt Lake. Salt Lake comes in and wins on the road. And David Ochoa, back in the news, boots the ball into the fans at the end of the game, then has all these Minnesota players coming after him, including Hassani Dotson, his U.S. under 23 teammate. And we've got some polemica here. And I know how you feel about this. Like, I have not come here to rip David Ochoa. I'm actually kind of enjoying having some of this in MLS.
Hallelujah. That's what I say to David Ochoa. And also, by the way, hallelujah to Minnesota and the way that they reacted, right? Like, Adrian Heath had a tremendous quote, which was like, boy, that's a lot from a guy, player who's not very good. Savage from Adrian Heath. This is what, as you said, polemica. This is what we need. We need some controversy. We need some players to stir it up. And I don't really love players enforcing unwritten rule. Oh, you don't boot it into the stand. Please. Come on. Like, we're going to become baseball. You really want MLS to become baseball where we're enforcing unwritten rules? Come on. Let's not have that. But I kind of like the fact that the next time that RSL and Minnesota United play each other, they're not going to like each other very much. Like, I think that's a really good thing. MLS needs more of this. More controversy. More characters willing to stir some bleep up. Some managers taking shots at other clubs after the game. What was that? Bob Bradley and Seb Salazar getting into it? We need more of that. And I don't think that MLS realizes that, like, this is, like, when they say, we want to be covered like the NFL. This happens right. In the NFL every week, right? You have to embrace when people criticize you, when controversy happens, when, you know, there's, like, league fines, like this Blaise Matuidi situation. I'm sure it doesn't look good for them, but they have to know that it gets them in the headlines. Like, the more you're in the headlines as a league looking for relevance, the better. However it is you achieve that, you almost, I mean, unless you're really, like, you're on the criminal side of things, if it's just a sporting, having fun, and, you know, kind of sporting level kind of controversies, this is great.
There's an element of, we miss Steven Lenard from this league, right?
Yes.
You know, not that many villains over the years. Latan certainly became a villain of sorts.
Yeah.
But there haven't been that many. And I don't want necessarily a guy who's going to come in and, like, try and break legs with tackles. But, like, a guy who's a villain, a fun villain? Yeah, that would be awesome. And maybe David Ochoa is that guy. Like, I'm going to give David Ochoa some credit here. He went through a horrible situation with his howler in Olympic qualifying. The team doesn't go through. And I don't think it takes an Einstein to suggest that maybe he was hearing some stuff about that from the fans last night in Minnesota. And that might have had something to do with what he did after the game. But for David Ochoa to earn the starting spot and not let this mistake in Olympic qualifying throw him completely off the rails, that's not bad.
Right.
He's he's playing on a team that goes and gets road wins at a team like Minnesota that people thought would be a playoff team, may still be, who knows. That shows me something. Now, maybe he has some growing up to do, but if he's got a chip on his shoulder, I'm not necessarily bothered by that.
No, and it's the mark of a confident player, right? It's the mark of someone who's not going to be kind of brought down because this happened. A couple of other points. Number one, Real Salt Lake is the only MLS club that does not have a single national television game. Not one this season.
Oh, really?
This is a club that is off the radar, and look at this, week two, and we're talking about them here. This is really good for them. But the other thing is just that we know that footballers are some of the most expressive athletes in the world. I'm actually really enjoying right now, as a result of the Football with Grant Wall interview, I follow Daryl Dike on TikTok now. He's got a great TikTok. Like, we know that there are probably these characters everywhere across the league. And for whatever reason, you know, the media, the social media, we just don't see it often enough. But I imagine there are characters like David Ochoa everywhere around the league that maybe don't feel comfortable, and they think that, you know, the league and their teammates and the club is going to come down on them if they express that. But let's go for it, man. Let's have some fun.
Fantastic. Great to talk to you as always, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Grant.
Let's take a quick break, and I'll ask you a question. Do you ever want to watch Spain's La Liga and France's Ligue 1, currently the best title races in Europe, and get frustrated because they're not available on your cable or satellite system? You should try a streaming service I use that I love. It's called Fanatis, and you can watch all the action from La Liga, Ligue 1, Copa Libertadores, and other international leagues and tournaments live and on demand from your favorite device, whether it's a mobile phone, a tablet, or directly on your TV with the Fanatis app. You can also watch top leagues from Austria, Turkey, Brazil, and Argentina. Fanatis features channels you know, like beIN Sports in English and Spanish, the women's soccer channel, ATA Football, Goal TV, and many more. And it costs as little as $7.99 a month. If you'd like to try Fanatis for yourself, you can get a free week-long trial by clicking on the link in the episode description or by going to fntz.co/grant-fz. Thank you very much to Fanatis for sponsoring this episode. Fanatis, the world's largest stadium. Now, here is my interview with Dermot McQuarrie. Our guest now is a guy who's had a fascinating career in sports and soccer broadcasting that spans several decades and a bunch of different countries and continents. Dermot McQuarrie is a South Florida-based broadcasting consultant these days. I met him a decade ago when he was a senior vice president at Fox Soccer and one of my bosses there. Dermot is a true pioneer who brought soccer leagues from around the world to U.S. television and helped create the Fox Sports World and Fox Soccer channels, as well as the daily soccer news show, the Fox Soccer Report in Winnipeg, Canada, which went on to Toronto and was a big part of the viewing lives of a lot of us. Dermot, it's great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited about this, and there's a lot to talk about here, and I want to get into your career pre-United States and your thoughts on today's soccer rights situation in the U.S. and your thoughts on the Super League, but I want to start with something else. In my opinion, the United States has gone from being one of the worst countries in the world in which to watch soccer on television to one of the best. So I want to start with the story of how you were a pioneer in bringing soccer to television in the United States. Where, in your opinion, should we start with you telling that story?
Well, I think you can go right the way back into, you know, into the dark ages with Toby doing voiceover, Toby Charles doing very bad commentary on the Bundesliga, but, you know, a legend in his own lunchtime. then really, if you wanted to watch football, can we call it football, soccer, you had to watch it in Spanish. That was basically it. Now, for example, Prime Ticket and Prime Deportiva were the two channels, which among 22 other ones that Fox bought in, I think, 1996, early 96. And they had these two Spanish language channels, one in North America and one in Latin America. And immediately they called them Fox Sports Americas, which everybody said to me, what a gringo term, you know, Fox Sports Americas. But excuse me. So I was just finishing a contract in Sweden where I was turning around a channel in Sweden in four languages, in Hungarian, Czech, Polish and English, doing sport during the day and movies at night. And that was a 6-month contract. And that's how long it takes to turn a channel around. It takes 6-7 months, you put new videos on, new programming, etc., etc. So I did that, just coming to the end of it, and I got a phone call from a friend who said, Tony Ball, the then president of Fox Sports, is going to call you. He said he's bought these channels and he's got two Spanish language channels. He doesn't know what to do with them. I said, okay. So I pick up the phone. Tony Ball says, "How's your Spanish?" I said, "It's okay," because I lived in Spain and Gibraltar for many years, so I spoke Spanish. I have to say my Spanish today is a lot better than it was in 1996. And so I came over. He says, "Come over for 2 or 3 days." And he said to me, "Tell me what you think of them. Keep them, close them, do something about them." I used to lie in my bed and have a laugh and think, I could have said, "Spanish broadcasting in the United States? Are you kidding me? They speak English in the United States. Shut them down and save yourself some money." Anyway, I didn't do that because they had a great team of people. And all they had was the wrong programming on these channels. Yes, in Prime Deportiva, they had soccer. I was just looking it up. They had, for example, the Argentinian Soccer League, Bundesliga, Copa del Rey, European Cup Winners' Cup, European World Cup qualifiers. This is in 96-97. French soccer, Portuguese soccer, Scottish soccer, South American World Cup qualifiers, Spanish Soccer League and UEFA Cup, among others. But, you know, that was fantastic. But they had it chopping and changing around, and it wasn't really doing all that well. Down in Argentina and Latin America, I am now a proud American citizen, very proud American citizen. But one of the problems America has, if a sport is popular in this country, it must be popular around the world, and we're going to ram it down your throat until it is popular. So they, down in Argentina, they had UNLV playing, I don't know, the Bruins or something. And people in Argentina are going, "Okay, yeah, who the hell are the Bruins?" Yeah. So I went down to Argentina and I remember launching the news and my boss at that stage saying to me, "What's the editorial policy?" I said, "Football, football, 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 football. What happens if Shaquille O'Neal scores 100 points? This is great. Football, football, Shaquille, football, 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 football." I said, "We will not miss a story." And I have to say, and I know this is slightly tangential, but we'll come back to the USA in a second. When I went to Argentina, Fox Sports Americas was 48th out of the top 50 channels. Somebody said to me, it came in just behind the knitting channel. And it didn't know what it was doing. So we put news on. One day I was in a taxi and I was listening to the radio, which the production company owned, La Red. And I thought they either play football, watch football, or talk about football. Right. So at 8 o'clock at night, we did a program called La Última Palabra. And it was simulcast on radio. And it took off. Biggest ratings on radio. Biggest ratings along with Fox Sports Noticias. And the one thing we did on Fox Sports Noticias, we never got the commentaries, despite being in Argentina, we never said here in Argentina or there in Mexico. We would just say in Mexico or in Argentina. As somebody said, Fox Sports Noticias was in a planet way off from planet Earth. Anyway, so and we took it from 48th out of 50 to the number one sports channel in Latin America and on occasions the number one channel against all others in Argentina. Wow. It did help. We had Maradona at the end of the phone most of the phone line most of the time. Anyway, to get back to the USA, so I come across for 3 days, and I remember they put me in the Hyatt Hotel in Century City. I got stood out in the balcony there. I phoned my friend in London who had put me in contact with Tony Ball. I said, "They sent me over business class, picked me up in a limo, they've put me in a suite." He says, "They're just trying to bribe you, son." I said, "Well, we're doing a damn good job at that." So Tony said to me, "How long is it going to take you?" I said, "It'll take me 6-7 months to turn it around. I've done it before, done it twice before. So, you know, let's get into it and we'll sort it out and make it good." During that time, I was still getting offers from people who I'd worked with previously in Central Europe saying, "Come on, we need you here. Come on, come on." I said, "I have a contract. I cannot leave them." I said, "Yeah, 6 month contract." And eventually I stayed for 18 and a half years. And so, you know, I did say to them, "Listen, at the end of," they said, "How long will you stay?" And I said, "Well, if we're still talking to each other in 6 months' time and we're not at each other's throats, I might stay a little longer." 18 and a half years.
Incredible. I like, what was it like, I guess, in the late 90s with the Fox Sports world channel and just the amount of soccer that you had that you were putting on American television? What was it like in those days, and how different is it from the way we see things today?
Well, I think there was a loyal soccer fan club of people who were either expats, Europeans. There are a lot of Americans who have watched it since they were born virtually. But when you consider that, first of all, the vast majority of clubs throughout the world were formed in the 1890s, and MLS was formed 25 years ago. It was a different audience. The Latin audience knows their football. And for example, we found that people said during World Cups and things, oh, well, if USA gets knocked out, that's me, I'm finished. You go, whoa, 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 whoa. You still got to watch the semi-final and you got to watch the final. Yeah, but the USA's not in it. Nah, that's not how you watch football. They haven't had the opportunity to stand behind the goals at the cop end. And until you can stand there and your father, grandfather, maybe even great-grandfather stood in that same spot, that's history of football, soccer. But there was this loyal audience. Sometimes there were delayed games, management sold off some games to ESPN when we got the Premier League contract. I really wasn't in favour of that, but it was more a financial decision. But it was a very limited audience. The advertising sales guys had a serious job trying to get advertisers to understand what this soccer was. What we did do was we persuaded the English Premier League that we could put clock commercials up, little tags on the clock that said whatever, Budweiser or somebody's tires or whatever it may be. And that was something we could sell to advertisers. Say, listen, any other sport, you've got to wait till the commercial break comes up. But we can put your advert on the screen for a minute during play. No one can turn it off. No one can change the channel. Yours is going to be there. And then in the news side of things, we were able to get sponsorship because we had eventually with Fox Soccer 40 million homes, which is good money coming in. But still, you need advertising support. And we had to find ways of how do we sell this to people. And of course, it's great if you go to things like the World Cup or European tournaments, play of the day, player of the day, shot of the day, anything of the day. We could do that. There was a real, people said it was crass. I didn't think so. And we did in the Spanish language channel, coming out of break, one host says to the other who's on the phone, what are you doing? He says, I'm using my, Samsung phone to order a pizza from Domino's or something like that. And everybody in the control room's gone, yeah. I said, shut up, you're going to get free pizzas. We sold our soul to the devil. But then what we did was that when you consider, and I was again doing some research on this. I'll try and be as quick as I can here. United Kingdom, Premier League, FA Community Shield, FA Cup, England Under 21, England National Football Team, Australia, the A-League, the State of Origin Series, Japan, the J-League, USL, MLS, UEFA Champions League, UEFA Europa League, CONCACAF Champions Cup, live coverage of the CONCACAF Gold Cup, Copa America Centenario, then FIFA World Cup 18 and 22, and the Under 17s, Under 20s, Women's, etc., etc. Apart from, and we eventually also had some Serie A games. We didn't have La Liga, but we had way, way back some games. We had everything. And it was amazing, and the amount of production we did. And added to all that, we had to change Fox Soccer and do Fox Soccer Plus because and Fox Sports World, we'd had rugby and some cricket and goodness knows what, darts. And look at the popularity of darts. Darts and snooker, billiards, my grandmother would have said the sign of a misspent youth. And that's what it is in Britain. If you can play darts and snooker, sign of a misspent youth. Look at darts nowadays. If you've ever watched a Sky Sports production from Crystal Palace, they can't get a place big enough. And these people are screaming at these heroes that they've got. Whereas previously it was, drunks that were throwing things at arrows at a board in a pub.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to me to think back to when I started getting Fox Sports World on my television. And for me, it was just this opening up of a world, you know, like that I hadn't really had exposure to before, just to be able to watch so many games. Do you have any fun stories about sort of any of the early days of getting those on American television and the conditions sort of in the studio, in how that compares to what we see today?
Well, technology across the world has improved dramatically, you know, and, you know, God bless them. We used to bring in games from maybe Bulgaria and it was in black and white, you know, and it was, and somebody would say, it's snowing. No, it's not. It's actually a nice summer's day down there. Then there was the time when, and you would try and contact the truck on site, you know, you'd get somebody who could contact, so you would touch base with people and they would usually go, oh, well, you know, in America, yeah, we're in America, we're taking that signal. And then there was, not long after I arrived, and it was must have been May, there was a Rangers game and a Celtic game being played both at the same time in Scotland. And the control room was having a terrible problem getting pictures. I said, it's okay. So I phoned the Scottish television truck and I phoned the BBC truck and I said, hi, it's Dermot here. Oh, hi, Dermot, where are you? I said, in America, in California. I said, you were taking your games. Oh, what can we do for you? I said, okay, give me some panning shots, you know, of the ground where we don't have any commercials. And I heard somebody saying, where's Dermot? Say, he's directing two outside broadcasts in Scotland at the moment, you know, from California. So those were good fun. And, you know, I think that we had a great team of production people, young guys and girls who were prepared to, you know, really get into it. They knew their football. And, you know, there was a girl from Spain, Susana Alocet, who sent me, which I still have, a big folder, and it said on it, so you think you know about Spanish football? And it was question after question after question. I looked at it and I phoned her. I said, come in, you start on Monday. and she really was one of the best producers. And the guys were scared stiff of her. One of the young producers walks in with a Barcelona jersey on. I said, you know that Susie's a Madrid supporter? Oh, God. And he takes it off and finds a Fox Sports T-shirt to put on. And then, you know, people say that unless you're at the stadium, I remember somebody cruelly saying to me in the UK, your producers are not producers. I said, oh, really? I said, why is that? Well, they're not at the game. They're not doing this, that, and the next thing. I said, listen, until you have sat in the chair and the production assistant's going 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. You roll the opening titles and it's colour bars coming from God knows where, you know, Berlin or Madrid or wherever it is, or London. That is the heart rate. Then your heart rate goes up and you shout, give me that feature, you know, such and such a thing. I said, because if you're at the game and something, your camera one goes down, you just cut to camera two. You know, do something at the moment. Now then, that very same person, when actually at Sky, they started taking European games in, I said, who's producing? Joe Schmo. I said, then again, he's not a producer, of course. I said, because he's not at the game. There were expletives, you know. And I said, hey, you know, until you have dealt with international feeds, you don't know what dealing with international feeds is about. It can be heart-stopping. And we were doing that, you know, Saturday, Sunday, Monday night, midweek, and then a whole stack of things. And you have to bear in mind that these same producers were producing NFL, MLB during the NFL and MLB season. And then in Houston, we were producing golf for Latin America. You know, massive amount of productions. But, you know, on the soccer side, I think that people started to learn about soccer. And I think pre-games are very important to try and explain, you know, the moves and things like that. You've got to be careful because you don't want to talk down to anybody, but right, you've actually got to explain what the moves are. You know, and for example, teaching the phrases that people expect to hear. And when I nearly took the famous Max Brettus's head off his shoulder when he referred to a head ball. And when on the key, I said, it's called a header! You know, sorry! And learning things like, yeah, of course, the goal line, but it's the byline. You know, the ball's gone over there, but head ball. And, you know, I think that we've done a certain amount of Americanizing soccer. Like, we will not, on Fox Soccer, there were certain things you were not allowed to say. If you, dear Grant, as a great expert, if you say, well, yeah, what happened was his cleats. They're called football boots. They're not called cleats. Those sort of things. And I think that people learned, and, you know, I remember MLS wanted us to call it the field. I said, it's called a pitch. It's not called a field. And there's that whole, one of the things I'd like to say, there is a great debate in television as to, should we have American commentators because right. Americans will listen to American commentators, or should we have British commentators because the credibility is there? Now, I know you know everything there is to know about football. Fine. But when you're getting, you know, Ian Dark, people like that, you know, there's just an extra bit. I used to have great fights with David Hill. He'd say, nah, it's got to be, it's got, and this is coming from with an Australian accent. He's saying to me, you got to have American soccer commentators. I said, listen, when we were at Sky, why did you have American commentators on the NFL programs? Shut up. I said, no, honestly, come on. One of my bosses used to say to me, Would you come to the meetings with David Hill? I said, why? He says, because they go so much better when you're there. Wonderful man, Mr. Hill. Wonderful man.
He's a legend as well.
Yes.
And how did the nightly news show come about, and why Winnipeg, Canada as the location for it?
Well, starting with why Winnipeg, Canada was because the company, the cable company up there, wanted to have a channel. They had to have a certain number of Canadian produced channels to be able to, you know, have their own an extra channel. And they came to us and said, could we have one called Fox Sports World Canada, and we want to take all your product in, but we've got to have a certain number of hours which are produced in Canada, and we could produce a news for you. And we said, okay, right, fine. Of course, that's where we got the great Bobby McMahon coming in, the legend, absolute legend. And I tell you what, the punters love Bobby. Oh, yeah. Lordy, do they love him. And so I went up to Winnipeg to set it all up. And apart from when I was in Stockholm in the middle of winter and it was minus 40 Celsius, the coldest place in Canada is the corner of Portage and Main in Winnipeg. So I'm there, and on the Sunday, I get up, and beautiful day. Now, in Winnipeg, if you've ever been there, there are tunnels that go, bridges that go from shop to shop to shop to shop, and there's a whole underground city underneath the shopping centre. So I cut down from the hotel I'm in, go down through all these columns, corridors, and I come out at the church, and I just walk across the road. A little bit chilly, but that's okay. Went to church there. When I come out, the sky is a stunning blue. The sun is shining, and I think, I'm going to walk back to the hotel. 30 seconds later, I am running back into the shopping centre. It was bitter. It was absolutely bitter. But again, a great group of people who tried hard, and, you know, Jeremy St. Louis and people like this, and Bobby, and, you know, and Ian O'Callaghan. But then they closed down Fox Sports World Canada. So, you know, the Canadian cable company closed down Fox Sports World Canada. So we thought, right, okay, we'll move. And then Toronto came along and said, mm-hmm. you know, we'll do that for you. So I said, okay. So I spent 6 glorious weeks in the summertime in Canada setting that up. It was absolutely fabulous in Toronto. They gave me this executive apartment, which And, you know, nothing started till later in the afternoon. So I watched the Olympics, you know, lying on a sofa watching the Olympics. It was glorious. I loved it being there. And again, a great group of... I have been very, very fortunate. People say to me, how many miles a year do you travel? Now, when I was going down to South America, I was on the road a week or 2 weeks a month. I used to do 150,000 miles a year. And they'd say, wow, that's a lot. See, but it's like, when you get there, it's the people you're working with. I have been privileged, whether it was USA, Mexico, Venezuela, Chile, Argentina, a phenomenal group of hard-working producers who were just great. There was none of them that you'd say, we've got to get rid of him, he's useless, you know. And they were all right into soccer or whether and feeding the news programs. And of course, the other thing where we were being cute was a thing called News Access. Now, News Access is kind of a figment of people's imagination, but I kept telling everybody it was a news program, and they went, it's a sports news program. No, it's a news program. It's, and we're using sports footage. So we were able to take 2 minutes of, you know, of anything and put it on our news. So there was nobody else. Okay, now even today, ESPN top 10 shots, and in number 5... bang, here's this goal.
Right.
And, of course, number 4 is a baseball or something like this. Whereas you were getting this 1 hour of soccer news, and it was being repeated. It's been repeated all damn night. And, you know, and so you got that. And I'll tell you a quick story about that. So the World Cup in France. I am desperately trying to get news access for Fox Sports Noticias. The authorities in Latin America say, no, no, no. The broadcasters are all frightened of Fox Sports Noticias, that you'll put it on the air before they do. At one stage, I said to them, I said, fine, I'm putting great big billboards outside every broadcaster's offices saying, watch Fox Sports Noticias and see what they're frightened of, you see? He says, you can't do that. Anyway, so the gentleman I was dealing with, Amaury Domas, and he was the head of the Latin American organization. So I phone him, and he's in Paris, and eventually he comes to the phone. I am going to give you 2 minutes of news access per day. He's Brazilian. I said, why is that? The Scottish fans were very respectful to the Brazilian national anthem. Well, rock on, eh? So, you know, you've dealt with lawyers and what contracts are like, you know, 2 inches thick. So I write him a letter that says, I authorize, I mean, it was just about news access of such and such, and he signs it, Amaury Domas. I walked into our legal department and said, that's what you call a contract, you see? But the story doesn't end there. You know, in Argentina, they have this most wonderful phrase, and I know you speak Spanish, si tú tienes el tape, tú tienes los derechos. And that's the way that our production company in Argentina works.
They if you have the tape, you have the rights.
Correct. They used it every which way, and Kike Wolf worked for us at that stage. He did a half an hour a night, you know, and highlights and examining things. So many weeks later, after the World Cup's finished, I'm in Chile talking to the Chilean, buying Chilean football, and the office says, Amaury Domas wants to talk to you. I thought, oh, lordy, he's found out how much footage we've used. My heart was in my mouth, and I paced up and down the hotel room going, please, God, help me, help me, help me. Phone his office. Dermot, how are you? I said, very well, thank you. How are you, Amaury? I have a friend that wants to make a sailing program, and he'd like to put it on Fox Sports. Would you be interested? Absolutely. Sailing programs are what we're looking for these days. Thank you, bye. Thank you, God. But that was part of the fun, you know, the fun of working for these with these people, you know.
You know, I miss the Fox Soccer Report. Yes. You know, it became part of my daily routine, this show. And I actually got to Winnipeg finally in, I think it was 2015, because the U.S. played Women's World Cup games in Winnipeg. And I felt like I was on hallowed ground because I'd watched this show from Winnipeg for so long. And what was interesting was that obviously Fox eventually got the World Cup rights in English in the United States. And when I joined Fox, I think it was 2012, and in Euro 2012 was the first thing I was doing for you guys. And it was Fox Soccer Channel was still a channel. and it wasn't a channel for much longer, and I miss that as well. And it just strikes me that at the same time as Fox was getting the biggest soccer event of them all, the World Cup rights, that the daily soccer person who watched the Fox Soccer Channel and the Fox Soccer Report eventually lost that stuff. And I don't know if I had the choice, if I would have preferred to not have Fox getting the World Cup rights and keeping the daily channel. What happened there?
Well, sadly, and this is the start of the hordes coming in wanting to buy soccer rights.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of it, you know, we did a deal with Setanta because there was only Setanta and ourselves who were interested in bidding in the Premier League. We didn't hear of anybody else, you know, bidding in the Premier League. Because we're talking millions, you know, a season. Not as much as NBC has ended up paying. But there was only Setanta and ourselves, and we said, okay, well, come on, we'll come in together so we're not spending too much money. We're having too much money, millions. But bit by bit, we lost the Premier League, then we lost European, they've just lost the Bundesliga. And... you know, lost, I think, the USL. And it just, I don't know. I don't know whether there was still the appetite for soccer. And then they, you know, having lost the Premier League, which is what Fox Soccer lived on, lived and died on, it then died, you know, and died in September. And they took things over to, you know, to some of the things on Fox Sports 1. And, you know, it just... bit by bit, drifted away. And now when you look at it, everybody's into soccer. I think NBC, for example, has done a tremendous job. They've poured a lot of money into it. I eventually moved the productions from 1400 South Sepulveda over to the lot because I said to David Hill, listen, you use that studio on a Sunday from September to February and it just lies there. Give it to me. I said, I'm not paying you. I said, because the damn thing's lying there. And eventually it took him a while and a few expletives and as usual. And one day from me when I went, you, and stormed out, he said, come back. He says, yeah. But that made a big difference. We used it for the Champions League, essentially, mm-hmm. you know, and that lifted the level of production. But I think NBC has done a great bit. Have you ever been up to Stamford to look at their facility yeah. there? I did a consultancy for one of the divisions of NBC, and I spent some time up there. I was most impressed with all the facilities there and the way they've got them laid out, and they've got that big empty floor down below ready for any extra studios yeah. and things. But then, you know, they came in, and you've now got, you know, CBS in there. You've got Amazon, Facebook. I don't think Google has come in on the market. They don't. They seem to have...
Not yet.
Not yet. But it's one of the... I don't say I dislike it, but I don't think economically it's particularly good. Chris Harris in World Soccer Talk was doing a big thing about how much it costs you for this, that, and the next thing. And sure, there's the 7-day free trial with FUBU or whatever it may be. But people talked about, well, I'm cutting the cord because I'm fed up. I want a la carte. If you total up now all the streamers you have to buy to be able to watch all the soccer that was on Fox Soccer or Fox Sports Deportes, that was a lot cheaper than today. And I also think one of the criticisms that we would get at Fox Soccer is, we never know when the Premier League's on. Sometimes it's on ESPN, sometimes it's on you. Look what's going to happen now. Amazon's going to get a package. You know, Facebook's going to get a package. NBC's got a package, or CBS, or some of these things. And I think they're all, you know, like, I think doing the programmes from London is a great idea because what difference does it make? You know, you're in London, which is, I think, and I worked there, the world centre of freelancers. You know, you can get any freelance in any language that you want in London. You won't get them in LA, you won't get them in Miami. But I don't know if this dividing the cake up as much is good for the viewers. Because, for example, if they do divide it up and you're a Southampton fan, and you say, oh, well, that's on such and such a channel. Oh, no, yeah, well, I've now got to watch it next week on this channel. You know, and, it was so much easier to switch on Fox Soccer in the morning, you know, and watch it.
Here's a question I have for you is, I would argue that there are still many, many millions of new soccer fans to be created in the United States. This is still very much a growing sport. It's not established here in North America like it is in Europe. How do you feel about these additional paywalls that have gone up? Like, I understand the economics of all of it, and so I get it. But do you ever wish, like I sometimes wish, that the television companies in the US would think about things in the longer term, that if you want to actually create more fans, you should not put up so many barriers to watching it. Am I being naive to the business world in thinking that?
No, because what we're talking about is the opium of the masses. And if you feed them free soccer, they're going to be hooked on it. And I think you've got to feed them free soccer. I think you've got to have good hosts and good analysts. you know, they don't all have to be the ex-topic. You know, you don't have to have Bex on there every week, as long as people are explaining things. And then you hopefully will have good games. But remember, sometimes you've got Southampton playing Bournemouth or something like that, you know, because the Premier League demands a home game with every team, that Sky's got to go to a home game with every team. But I think what you've got to do is you've got to put it on the big, you know, the free-to-air, and put the big games on the free-to-air. Arsenal, Chelsea, City, United, Liverpool, Everton. Get those on, you know, onto the on free to air. And when it comes to the Champions League, sure, you can mess about with the early rounds and the qualifications. Although I will say, is what they should do and what we did. We put everything on from as soon as the draw was made. Get these things on. People say, what team's that? It doesn't matter. You know, get it onto the television. We're a soccer channel, and I think that it is the opium of the masses. And you've got to help the people to learn, because while yes, some people have been watching since the 50s and things like this, MLS is only 25 years old, 26 years old. And I know that there are people who say, yes, it's going to be one of the greatest leagues in the world. And you go, really? Okay, fine. Well, build up to being one of the greatest leagues in the world. You can't start a league and suddenly it's going to become one of the greatest leagues in the world. People don't think that's true. It's getting there, and I think it's marvellous. I remember after 10 years, there was a panic at 10 years. Will we make it more than 10? Yes, and now then 20. And it's amazing what they've done. And of course, there's always the relegation, promotion, and all that sort of stuff. If they actually, I believe, if they make the USL, and they're like, you know, here in Fort Lauderdale, where we've got FC Fort Lauderdale rather than right. FC Miami. And have you seen the stadium?
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. I hope they never build the thing in Miami. Yeah. And just leave it here.
You may get your wish.
bring the striker fans in, you know. But if they can, I'm sure, and I understand the economics of it. 1996, Alan Rothenberg goes to these billionaires and says, hey, we're going to start this soccer league. What? Come on. Throw your money in here. You know, and Lamar Hunt was the only guy who knew anything about football, you know.
Right.
And they got them in, but they had to keep them in because they don't understand that if your team goes down, there's still going to be a hell of a good games in the league below, but it's not the big league. Look at, for example, look at the Championship now in England. Huge stadiums, packed stadiums, great games, yeah. But Premier League is Premier League. And I think that, you know, that there is a growing number. I don't think they've learned to give their heart and soul to a team yet. And I think that while we don't want violence, I saw, I can't remember the two teams, but two sets of fans, and the one team had lost, the other team had won, and they're high-fiving each other. You go, really? You know, no, you don't need to slap them, but just look away. No, yo, that was a great game, my man. I said, so what are you doing? He's got a different scarf from you.
Oh, shoot. I wanted to get your opinion. Like, this whole Super League fiasco has been the story of the year, what's happened over the past week. And one of the moments that stood out to me before the whole thing just completely went under was when Amazon releases a statement on its Twitter saying, we're not interested in this league. And it surprised me. At that moment, I was like, well, if one of the prospective carriers of this league is going this far to say publicly that they don't want to be associated with it and they aren't going to pursue the rights for it, that it really is one example of why this plan's not going to happen. What do you think happens now? Because to me, from like a pure business perspective, so leaving aside everything else, this Super League idea could still happen down the road and it could still make a lot of money. But where do you think like broadcasters fit into that? And do you think broadcasters, given better planning for a future Super League proposal, might line up for it?
Well, without any evidence, but that's never stopped me in the past. I think somebody tipped either Bezos or somebody high up and said, hot potato, Jeff, don't touch it with a barge pole. Don't touch what? Hey, wait a minute, Glazer and Kroenke and Henry, I know them all. I've had cocktails with them. These are good guys. They own soccer clubs. Don't touch it. Nobody phoned Jamie Damon at JP Morgan and said, Jamie, right, don't touch it. Get your $4 billion and put it back in your pocket, you know. Did you notice DAZN said,
yep,
we're interested. They want to be trying to be world dominant. Now, the DAZN question is for another long podcast. But anyway, I wonder if, jokingly, the phone call came from Perez and came to the three great guys, because Americans are getting slagged off in the UK about
right.
it. Oh, don't say you're American if you go to London. Go, hello there, I'm Scottish, because you'll get killed. So Perez, say, phones the three of them and says, got this great idea, it's only a game midweek, or we'll find a date for it, billions of dollars. The three of them say, well, he knows about soccer. We don't know really anything about soccer. He must think it's a good idea. We're in for that. But as I said to somebody, okay, John Henry and Glazer and Kroenke, you two go to the NFL, and John, you go to the MLB and say, we're starting a super MLB league and we're starting a super NFL league. See how far that gets you? And that's the point of it. You know, it looked like, I think, and I know Ed Woodward was involved in it and things like that, but I mean, but it looked like this bunch of foreigners coming in trying to tell us how to run football that's been going since 1896 and things like this.
Right.
I thought it was badly handled. It was bull in a china shop time. It wasn't gently, you know, let's test the water here. Do you think there's a possibility? Talk to FIFA, talk to UEFA. You know, you get more through, you know, honey than vinegar and things. It was just bulldoze through. This is what we're going to do. And I did think the good thing was one of the teams was Tottenham Hotspur. People said, Tottenham Hotspur, I haven't won a title in New York for 60 years. You know, what's that? Poor old Rangers wasn't invited. 55 titles. Come on. Celtic, British winners of the European Cup. Come on. And I just think it was very badly handled. Would it be attractive? Yeah. And I thought also what was it, not only was it Amazon, the serious nail in the coffin was from the Bundesliga, who said,
yeah,
no, we ain't doing that. Now, and, you know, the Italians doing it. And then I think DAZN probably, wait a minute, we've got Italian rights, we've got Bundesliga rights. There's Bundesliga saying no. Now the Italian authorities, none of the authorities said, we think this is a good idea. because right. nobody spoke to anybody. It was a case of, here's the truck full of money, you'll all join in. Would the games be great? Yeah. Can you imagine, you know, some of these games? It'd be fantastic. But, you know, I don't know if it will come back. It's awfully tainted. I think that's one of its problems. It's very, very tainted. But, you know, who knows? We don't know what's coming down the pike these days with regard to, you know, regard to football.
Yeah, no, totally true. I wanted to wrap up, and I appreciate you taking this much time.
Sure.
Do you have a sense of pride now when you look at how big the business of soccer television rights has gotten in the United States now? Do you have a sense of pride when you look at your role in the creation of this?
I have pride for the teams who put it there. Yes, myself. And I have still a great contact. He no longer works for Fox either. And I text him, say, see what's on television? We had that long before anybody else. Now they're thinking, they're advertising as if it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Excuse me. We put it on the TV, you know. But it was, I have pride for what we did at Fox Soccer, what we did at Fox Deportes, what we did at Fox Sports in Latin America, and it all came down to the teams of people that were there. They were great, great people with great ideas. When I came to Fox Sports in 10,000 Santa Monica Boulevard, I was being taken round by the chief accountant. I said, where are all the computers? Yeah, we don't have any. Fine. Get me 25 computers. And I said, and we need to move the desks around. I said, I want telephones and I want everybody to have a little miniature television. And I'd say to somebody who was an intern and we're giving him a job, I said, now here's what you do. Put your voicemail on your extension, then phone your mum and tell her to phone your extension so she knows you've got a real job now. Oh, he says, she was so pleased when she heard my voice. That gave me more pride than anything else. And to finish, all the senior staff, when I left, had started as production assistants or editors. And we trained them and brought them up. And they then, that was their legacy, you know, to train the next level and bring in people. And I think we made a damn good job of it.
Dermot McQuarrie is a South Florida-based broadcasting consultant these days and a true pioneer in American soccer television. Dermot, thank you so much for joining me.
As they say on PBS, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Football with Grant Wall. I'd like to thank Dermot McQuarrie as well as producer and pundit Chris Whittingham. If you like the podcast, you could do me a huge favor and hit that subscribe button and provide a rating and a review. I'm back soon with another interview of someone from the soccer world. Be safe, everyone. See you next time.